I'm Christopher Lydon, and this is Open Source with a key, finally, to the mystery of Donald Trump and where he came from. He was born almost exactly 100 years ago in the imagination of the novelist F. Scott Fitzgerald. What he stands for by now is a sort of MAGA question. Can Donald Trump make America Gatsby's again? As in The Great Gatsby, published in 1925. The book makes every list of great American novels, but it's more than that. It's a high-style satire and prophetic tragedy about a dreamer who invented not just a fake self, but a whole cast of rich, mostly repellent characters and wannabes all around him. Those famously careless people who smash things up for as long as they can and then let other people clean up their messes. Our guest Sarah Churchwell is not the first to make the Gatsby-Trump connection, but nobody has mapped it as broadly as you have, Sarah. It's not just those two famous names and men, but it's the eras and the ideas that drive them. I read your brilliant essays in the Financial Times, and I come to know you as a Chicago-born American teaching the humanities at the University of London. How did you come to link Trump with Gatsby and the ideas, large and small, that drive their stories?
I was chuckling a little bit when you said I wasn't the first, because in one sense I was one of the first, because I've been doing it since 2015. And, you know, since Trump came on the political scene, really, I had just finished my book about Gatsby at that point, which came out in 2013, 2014, when Trump came along. One of his early slogans before Make America Great Again was, of course, America First. And, you know, everybody was horrified when he used it, right? But they all made the connection to Lindbergh. But America First, as I knew from studying the 20s, was a massively popular political slogan in America in the 20s. The connection was very, very explicit and obvious to me from that moment. And it seemed to me that this was being widely misread. And then as soon as you make that link, you start to see the ways in which Trump is so clearly, and Trumpism, you'll remember, you know, when he first came on the scene, we were debating whether Trumpism was a thing. And now we know very much that it is, that it's a movement. And it is a political style and a political movement that Fitzgerald very much anticipates in Gatsby. He doesn't predict it in any literal sense, but he maps a trajectory that the country is on, and that trajectory takes us to Trump.
Yes, and your take is different precisely in a way that I've hungered for. It lets us see Donald Trump as an outgrowth of our culture more than our elective politics. When you think of him as a version of Gatsby, he becomes more a creation of our history, more a symptom of all of us than a driver or the cause of all these events.
Absolutely. I genuinely don't think that he is a cause of these events. I mean, of course, he is an agent and he is creating change, but he is a symptom. In my most recent book, which is about how Gone with the Wind can help us understand Trumpism and Trump, I do talk about him exactly as a cultural outgrowth. And the metaphor I use in that book is that Gone with the Wind and Trump grew on the same family tree. And they're both outgrowths from that family tree. And I do talk in terms of those kinds of growths out of culture, right? The word culture and cultivate have the same roots. These are about the things that we let grow in our society and the things that we nurture and the things that we don't. I will say, I think that Trumpism is a cancer. He's a symptom, but there's also a tumor that you need to cut out. There is something toxic in the system. There's something toxic in the bloodstream, and we have not rooted it out. Gatsby is about that darkness in our culture. It's about the ways in which what drives us and makes us great is at the root of so many of our failures and our disappointments, and indeed in that novel, our tragedies.
You're right, Sarah Churchwell. Trump has taken us all into Gatsby's world, where dreams wither beneath corruption and malice. And you credit Scott Fitzgerald for all of this. You say he observed the deepening fault lines in American society in the early 1920s, and he guessed right. He foresaw tragedy in the country's impulse toward grandiosity and self-destruction in its reckless dishonesty. The novel's prescience lies not in foretelling specific events, but in diagnosing a culture where power enjoys impunity and cruelty rubs out its traces, a society run by careless people. Gatsby is prophetic, you write, not for advancing a political theory of decline, but for capturing the emotional logic of a society in thrall to raw power.
you know, it's not a political manifesto, right? It's not a treatise. It's not a theory of power, but it's capturing something about the emotional truths of American society. And one of those truths is the degree to which we will lie to ourselves and lie about our society to ourselves. Even our reading of Gatsby is symptomatic of that tendency because we lie to ourselves about Gatsby, or we misread it, right? Because we see it as a novel about glamour and about greatness and about grandeur. And that's not what it's about. It's about disappointment. It's about failure. It's a tragedy. There's not a happy ending, you know?
We keep meeting ourselves coming around the corner. Aren't we talking about two parables, 1925 and 2025, two parables of End Times USA, set among these monstrous fakes, caricatures of all sorts of New York power figures, although Trump and Gatsby are both outsiders too. Trump from Queens, drooling over gilded Manhattan. Gatsby, nay, Gats, from the Dakotas. And we're talking about all those New York types that we wanted never to know, like the power lawyers today in firms like Paul Weiss, who will sell their souls for a link to the Trump White House. But they're New Yorkers as grown-ups, too grand for the New York Times to have covered, which I think is part of the reason we understand so little of what's going on these days.
We could talk for an hour about, you know, New York culture and New York society more specifically, and the way that it stands as a kind of synecdoche for America at large in the novel. But so first of all, I want to take on the idea that we should be comparing Trump and Gatsby, because I do not compare Trump to Jay Gatsby. The thing about Gatsby—
It's really Tom Buchanan and Donald Trump, in a sense, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I'm not going to let poor Jay Gatsby be tainted by this association. Gatsby is a criminal. He's a crook. We shouldn't sentimentalize him. But he has something redemptive in him, which is a capacity for greatness, a capacity for wonder and hope, for fidelity. Donald Trump has none of those things.
Right.
Gatsby has the soul of an artist, and Donald Trump most certainly does not have that. What they share is showmanship, right? They share that bit of fakery. But yeah, Tom Buchanan is the Trump figure in the novel. Inherited wealth, a bigot, a bully, violent, chronically unfaithful to his wife, and stupid. I mean, it's really important to note that Buchanan went to Yale.
Played football.
Yeah, he has the veneer of an education, but we are told over and over again, Nick tells us several times, and he uses words like foolish, how dumb Buchanan is. He uses words like gibberish to describe what Buchanan says. And of course, Buchanan's white supremacism is absolutely central to the way that Fitzgerald characterizes him. He is terrified that he's in a racial panic, terrified that the migrant hordes, the racialized migrant hordes are coming into the country and taking power from him. And so, you know, he literally could be somebody watching Fox News right now, watching Tucker Carlson and saying the migrants are coming for us. We have to beat them back. We have to keep them out.
We'll come to that, the philosophical or theoretical notions of what's happening. But let's just tick off some of the similarities between these characters. Also, start with the difference. I mean, Trump comes across infinitely less charming than Jay Gatsby, who is described, among other things, this way. He smiled understandingly, much more than understandingly. It was one of those rare smiles with a quality of eternal reassurance in it that you may come across four or five times in life. It faced or seemed to face the whole external world for an instant and then concentrated on you with an irresistible prejudice in your favor. You want to meet that man.
Absolutely. And that's, again, not a description of Trump. Gatsby is, he does represent America. You know, he is a representative man. He represents certain tendencies in humanity, and he symbolizes the country in important ways. That's why it matters that he dies. That's why it matters that he doesn't survive the loss of his dreams. But his capacity for greatness is real. And as I say, his ambitions, his hopes, he's got the soul of an artist, and he's got all this charm, as you say. So he is redeemable. He is a redemptive figure, but he doesn't survive the loss of his own ideals. But he's an idealist. Donald Trump is not an idealist in any way, shape, or form. He is the most cynical human being probably to ever take power in the United States.
Talk about another connection that fascinates me, the gaudiness among their pals. Donald Trump has his Elon Musk. Gatsby has this racketeer Wolfsheim, the man who fixed the World Series in 1919, a racketeer. And Gatsby himself is a bootlegger.
Gatsby's not just a bootlegger, right? We know he's involved in financial fraud. That becomes clear by the end of the novel. He's basically got his finger in all of Wolfsheim's pies. And at that time, being a bootlegger and a gambler and a racketeer often included narcotics, for example. So The novel isn't explicit about that the way it is about his financial deals, but he's a swindler. That it probably is the thing that makes him closest to Trump, actually, now that we say that. That we can have that parallel. You know, Fitzgerald wrote a letter after the novel was finished to his editor, Max Perkins. They were talking about the blurb for the book and the jacket copy and stuff. And Fitzgerald said to Max Perkins, be very careful in all of the marketing for the book that you don't give away the fact that Gatsby is a crook, because it's very important that isn't clear until the end, right? So he's very clear that Gatsby is a crook and that he should be understood as one, as I say. So there, I will give us that. We can have that parallel between Gatsby and Trump. They're both crooks.
Sarah, speak of one of the big, serious underlying themes here of incredible self-absorption among the principals. They're always about themselves, and Trump surely fits that category. But the self-mythologizing as a kind of sport, it's a compulsion, it's a habit among the people in Gatsby. They are truly self-invented men with all the risks.
Well, Gatsby is, right? I mean, Buchanan isn't in the same way. And Nick Carraway, arguably. One of the things that often, I think, escapes people's attention because the novel is so beautifully written and that pulls us into it, is that actually there are no admirable characters in it, with the arguable exception of Nick. But Nick behaves very badly in lots of ways. You know, in many ways, it's a novel full of despicable people.
Yeah.
And it's important that we grasp that that's part of what, you know, Fitzgerald is saying about America. If you look at that famous list of names of the people who attend Gatsby's parties, and this is what you alluded to a minute ago when you were talking about the characters in Gatsby's world and the kind of gaudiness and seediness and vulgarity of these people, these New Yorkers who come to Gatsby's parties. There's the famous list of names that Nick Carraway writes down, and it's a mock epic list of these, you know, comedy names, but a great many of them are actually weasels and fishy. And that's part of the joke, right? There's a character called Civet. There's the fish guards. There's the hammerheads. There's Beluga, the tobacco importer, and Beluga's girls. There's a ferret. That's it. It's not weasel. It's some James Rotgut ferret. These are the characters that populate the world of Gatsby. And they're all weasels and ferrets to a certain extent.
People talk about having a Gatsby party or being at a Gatsby party. All the fancy people. And the host who doesn't drink at his own parties.
Yeah, I don't think that's what happens at most Gatsby parties today, though. Is it the host who doesn't drink?
The modern equivalent with Trump would be a MAGA rally. And nobody I know wants to put on one of them.
Not nobody that I know does either. But a lot of people still like attending them, don't they? I mean, look, there is a through line. You know, you may not think that there's a lot of comparison between a Gatsby party and a MAGA rally. But they have one thing very clearly in common. And that's the word great. Right?
Yeah.
They both subscribe to fantasies of greatness. They're driven by the same emotional machinery, the need to believe in greatness and to reclaim something that feels lost, which both are also trying to do. So all of this is about self-justification, right? You say it's about these self-absorbed characters and the promise that you can make the world whole again if only you believe hard enough or if you blame the right people. They're all surface, right? But the surfaces are there, whether it's anger or glamour. It's there to distract from the violence underneath it.
Interesting.
It's there to veil the violence under it.
I just want to note, though, that there's an attempt at style, at elegance in the Gatsby crowd, completely foreign to the Trump crowd. Just in the contest over taste and personal style, Gatsby wins hands down. And the glamour was real. I'm thinking of Daisy Buchanan getting somehow into Gatsby's wardrobe. And she weeps at the sight of especially his shirts, which he has made in London. She says, "They're such beautiful shirts." Her voice was muffled in the thick fold. "It makes me sad," she says, "because I've never seen such beautiful shirts before."
The glamour is very real. And the glamour in the novel comes less from the characters, I would argue, than from Fitzgerald's prose. His prose is unbelievably glamorous. And of course, glamour means magic, right?
Yes.
It is magical prose. It is prose that brings the world to enchanted life. And he does it. I mean, I'll give you one example. There are flowers all the way through the novel, of course, right? Daisy is a flower. She says, Nick is like a rose. Nick says, it's a lie. I'm not faintly like a rose. She's always opening up in a flower-like way. There are all of these images of flowers in it. But one of the things that Fitzgerald does is he uses synesthesia throughout the novel. He blends sensory impressions so that he is giving us surprising blends. You know, I'm sure all of your listeners know what synesthesia is, but so, right, he's attaching the quote unquote wrong sensation to a given object or to a given experience. The flowers in Gatsby, and this is just one example, but I love this one. He talks about, in fact, when they're right before they see the shirts, it's when they're walking into Gatsby's mansion. They're walking past, Nick tells us, the sparkling odor of jonquils and the frothy odor of hawthorn and plum blossoms and the pale gold odor of Kiss Me at the Gate. So smell sparkles, smell froths, and smell is pale gold. It has a color, right? That is glamour. That's where the glamour comes from.
That is writing.
That is writing.
I got to say, it's just such a pleasure to be reading this prose again, my Lord. The point that's so powerful in your fresh take on Gatsby is that Fitzgerald is warning us. He sees it. He sees a forecast of monstrous trouble, which we don't generally associate with Gatsby, a conscious warning from the author, beware. This novel was given to a couple of 100,000 American troops who went to war in 1941 and 2 and 3 and 4. And it made you wonder, they must have thought, this is what we're fighting for. This is the great American story of opportunity, adventure, risk, dream. And yet, Fitzgerald is also telling a completely different story. Summarize that. What is he warning us?
First of all, in terms of the armed services editions, it's worth remembering that Gatsby's very short and that made it cheap to produce. And that was one of the reasons why it was given.
And to read.
And to read. And that was one of the reasons it was given to soldiers. And of course, that, as you know, that drove the novel's renaissance because it had been, you know, kind of forgotten until then. And as you say, it's not exactly flag-waving patriotism. So it might seem like a surprising choice. But it is a novel about, not about the triumph of the human spirit, but it's a novel about the persistence of the human spirit. It's about the fact that we keep pushing forward, that we are, in Fitzgerald's word, undespairing, that even when we should despair, we don't. And I think that's the redemptive thread. It's not in success or the achievement of the dream or the fulfillment of the dream. It's in the refusal to stop hoping. And that is, you know, for me, what is hopeful about the novel, despite it being a tragedy. And I think it's one of the reasons why people finish reading it and almost somehow don't register that it's a tragedy because of that sense of the persistence of hope. But he does recognize that hope is also doomed, right? It's essential, but it's doomed. And that's the paradox of hope that kind of keeps spinning through the novel.
Yes. And with your help, I mean, I see it very differently now. Gatsby doesn't reach the green light. He doesn't get Daisy back. At the same time, he stands by his dream.
Exactly.
And we give him credit for that.
100%. Yeah, he's an idealist, right? I mean, I actually think fundamentally, in Fitzgerald's mind, it was a novel about what room is there for idealism in a fallen world, in modern life. Can an idealist survive? Gatsby is a mystic in a lot of ways. And Fitzgerald was really interested in philosophy to a degree that people don't credit him for being. And that's something I've written about a lot in my scholarship on Fitzgerald. It interests me a lot.
Sketch his philosophical tendency. What's he up to?
He was a romantic. He was a romantic philosopher.
It's a key line from Fitzgerald that Gatsby's great talent is his extraordinary gift for hope. And we're giving him credit for that now. It's not just illusion, although there's a lot of illusion in it. He has a capacity for wonder. Even so, he's overtaken by the death of his dream of Daisy Buchanan coming back to him, which comes to this question of the famous line where somebody says, you can't go back, you can't repeat history.
You can't repeat the past. It's Nick says it.
Yeah, and Gatsby says, of course you can.
Yeah.
And that is his trap, but also his saving grace in some way.
Yeah, exactly right. That faith, right? So another way of talking about it is that it's a novel about good faith and bad faith, which is very much, in my view, the situation that we're in, you know, today.
Yeah, let's talk about it.
The story of American society today, in my view, in fact, not just in America, I live in London, and if we look at what's happening around the world, it is a contest between people who are operating in good faith and people who are operating in bad faith. And The Great Gatsby is a novel about good faith versus bad faith. Gatsby operates always in good faith in terms of his fidelity to his ideals. He doesn't operate in good faith in the world. He's a criminal, and that matters. But he operates in good faith in relationship to his ideals and to his dreams. It's not just his extraordinary gift for hope. It's his extraordinary gift for fidelity. And it matters, therefore, that all of these characters are sexually unfaithful, because it is a novel about fidelity. That's a set of metaphors for playing through questions about who's faithful and who's unfaithful. That's why Tom is chronically unfaithful, because he is a character who operates fundamentally in bad faith all of the time.
I should have said earlier that there's a common, in terms of Gatsby and Trump, there's a common cruel carelessness with women.
Oh, yeah.
Trump's many wives, and God knows what else. Tom Buchanan's doomed girlfriend, Myrtle, who becomes a key player. Fit that into the larger moral here.
Another way of putting it would be to say the question that the novel poses in plot terms, or even if you like the mystery of the novel, which we don't know until the end, is the question of, is Daisy operating in good faith or bad faith? And it turns out that Daisy's operating in bad faith, too.
Bad faith in pretending that she could leave Tom Buchanan, she could come back to Gatsby, that she only loved Gatsby in all her life.
Bad faith in the sense that she abandons him to his fate. I mean, she's the one driving the damn car, and she abandons him to literally take the fall for her. She throws him under the bus, literally and figuratively, and just flees and just abandons him to his fate.
Sarah, come back to what Scott Fitzgerald is saying to us in the 21st century, in our 2020s, about recovery, about persistence in one's dreams, but also in this great question about, can you bring back the past? Can the United States repeat its past? What part of the past would we want to repeat? At what price? And after Trump is finished, whenever that happens, what will be left of America's promise to her people? In effect, the green light on Daisy's dock. What will be left of that? Hang on, there's something out there. And putting it a little differently, will Trump be remembered as a Jay Gatsby, a tragic hero, a dreamer, or Gatsby the fraud, or as Tom Buchanan, or as some combination of them?
When we say, can we repeat the past, and you say, which part of it would we even want to? A lot of people have pointed out that this phrase, make America great again, there's an implicit unasked question in it, which is great for whom? Because in the past, it wasn't great for a lot of people. And for a very small proportion of our society, that might seem like it was great for them, but it was at the cost of the rights of everyone else. So would I want to go back to earlier eras? Of course not. It was a terrible time to be a woman, roughly before I was born. I mean, my mother struggled with stuff, you know, and I come from a pretty privileged background. So the idea that it was easier, greater than, is a fantasy, right? And that's the point about saying you can't repeat the past. Of course, it's a fantasy to think you can repeat the past, but it's also a fantasy to think that you would want to. And this is part of what the novel sees very clearly, and certainly what Trump and his enablers are doing, is trying to rewrite progress as decline, trying to say that we've declined when actually we've progressed. And that the ways in which we've progressed is by expanding the rights of the citizens in our society, slowly, grudgingly, gradually, three steps forward, two steps back. But we have gradually expanded the rights and the opportunities and the possibility and the potential for people in our society. And what Trumpism does is says that is decline. Well, it is not decline from my point of view. You talk about, you know, what will happen after Trump and, you know, will America still be able to believe in the green light? And I'll tell you something about the green light that I really love, which came out of my very geeky deep dive into the early 1920s. Because, of course, as you know, Gatsby takes place in 1922. And one of the things I wanted to do was really, really immerse myself in the world of 1922, specifically to understand the world that Fitzgerald was bringing to light. And it's worth reminding people, I always think, because, as you say, we're at the exact centenary right now. And I hope after this conversation, people will want to go reread Gatsby. So if they do, I would just urge everyone to bear in mind an analogy, because the dates work exactly. So the novel was published on April 10th, 1925. So obviously we're now in April 2025 as we're speaking. It's a novel that's set in 1922. He first conceived it in 1920. Well, he started conceiving it in 22. He starts really thinking about it more carefully in 23. And he writes it in 24 to be published in early 25. So what we should be doing is imagining a novel about America today as we read it, if we want to try to understand it, to understand how contemporary it was. That what we need to be doing is imagining it, reading a novel today that is set in 2022 was written in 2024 and just published. It is about right now.
1922, we're in the wreckage of World War One, in a certain sense, yep. A time of prosperity broadly.
Not yet.
Well, it's coming, but also coming. Fascism is coming. And you encourage us to think that Fitzgerald saw it coming.
He was in Rome when he finished the novel. Mussolini took power in 1922, that same year that Gatsby is set. That is the same year that Hitler is mentioned in the New York Times for the first time. He's just starting to gain power. It's the year that he adopts the swastika, or I think maybe adopted the year before. But anyway, he's adopted the swastika. He's starting to get into the news. He's still a fringe politician in Bavaria, but they're starting to notice him a little bit. Fitzgerald writes most of Gatsby in France in 1924, as I'm sure most of your listeners will know. But what a lot of people don't realize is that he finished it in Rome. So in the autumn, he and Zelda moved from the south of France to Rome, and he finished it literally under the shadow of Mussolini's fascism. So yes, he knew what was going on. It was in front of his face. It's not a novel about fascism, obviously, but it's a novel about cruelty. It's a novel about dominance. It's a novel about authoritarians. It's a novel about bigotry. It's a novel where reckless speed destroys everything. Hmm. Of course, Daisy is speeding out of New York, and that's when she kills Myrtle, and that is how everything unravels. And that recklessness is
dare I say, it reminds me of the Silicon Valley phrase, move fast and break things.
Exactly that, right? I mean, the connection is very clear. To say that move fast and break things is a good way of moving through the world, I am afraid I disagree. Gatsby is a novel that is diagnosing what happens when you move fast and break things. Everybody dies. That's what happens. Everything gets destroyed, right? It's really important to say, too, that it's a novel about waste and despoliation. It's a novel full of ashes. It's a novel not just about Gatsby's extraordinary gift for hope, but we are told at the beginning, it's also about the foul dust that floated in the wake of his dreams. And that foul dust is what is created when you move fast and you break things. And what I was going to say, though, but let me tell you about the green light, though, because you'll like this. And it goes back to the point about what we think America, you know, might be able to see or to do again. We always think of the green light in Gatsby as that symbol of progress, right? And, you know, green lights meaning go. But the thing that I found about it when I was digging into 1922 specifically is that it was at the end of 1922 when New York installed traffic lights for the first time on Fifth Avenue. Yeah.
Wow.
And the system of red, yellow, and green had been in existence for trains for a while. So people knew that system. They understood what it was supposed to mean. But then, bizarrely, when they implemented the traffic lights in New York, and by the way, they weren't really lights because they were traffic signals because they didn't have, it wasn't all electrified yet. So they couldn't use lights. But what they did was they had these towers and a policeman stood in the tower and he would drop red, yellow, or green, a card or, you know, some kind of screen or something into this little slot. And then you could see whether it was red, yellow, or green. But there are these letters to the New York Times in 1923 and 1924, where everybody's talking about the fact that nobody understands what the colors mean, and that they all think it means something different. So green seems to mean stop, but if you're going to east to west, it maybe means go. But then people say, oh no, green means slow down. No, green means speed up. It's chaotic. They literally don't know what the green light means. And to me, that is so wonderfully apt. It's so perfect. Mm. Gatsby doesn't know whether the green light is telling him to stop or to go or what direction he should be traveling in. And frankly, neither does America. So the chaos of it and the confusion of it, I think, is so wonderfully humorous.
Come back, Sarah, though, to the chaos and confusion in our heads today. A lot of people have come to believe that January 6th, 2020, 21st century, was an introduction to our own fascist streak, maybe feeding on our own fixation on a regenerative past to make America great again. Fitzgerald was telling us that we were moving backward and forward at the same time. We were reaching out toward the light. At the same time, the ground was shifting. So we beat on, boats against the current. We are born ceaselessly into the past. Apply that to our world today. If it's true, if it's relevant, if it's deep, who's going to tell us? In film, in a novel, in a political speech, what do we do finally with such wisdom as there is, and there is wisdom in Fitzgerald.
First of all, I would say that January 6th was not our introduction to fascism. It was when fascism made it to the Capitol. But our introduction to fascism came during Fitzgerald's lifetime. It came in the interwar period, and Fitzgerald lived through it, and he saw it, and he knew it. There were American fascist groups in the interwar period. We had more colored shirts groups than anyone else in Europe, and people joked about it at the time in 1934, 1935. We didn't just have brown shirts and black shirts. We had gray shirts and khaki shirts. We had white shirts. We had silver shirts. They called it the Haberdashery Brigade and joked about the fact that we had so many colored shirts, which also gives a different angle to Gadsby and his colored shirts too, but that's another story. So the point is are we being dragged back into the past? Well, yes, the sense that we can't escape it. Well, for somebody like me who studies interwar fascism as part of what I do, that is what we're being drawn back into, only now it's taking power in a way that it wasn't able to do before.
The 1920s, when Scott Fitzgerald was writing, was also a big time for the Ku Klux Klan in America. Birth of a Nation, the film and all that.
Absolutely. It's in the novel. Tom Buchanan's a white supremacist. He is very, very clear about his white supremacism. We are introduced to Tom Buchanan as a white supremacist. And readers are sometimes thrown by this as if it's some kind of, you know, random detail that Fitzgerald put in. But it's absolutely central to the way that Fitzgerald understands how American power works. Tom Buchanan symbolizes American power, and Fitzgerald was very clear that American power was, and I would say is, white supremacist to its core. Now, the Klan, as you say, was taking power in the early 20s. And in 1921 and 1922, just as it starts exploding across the United States, it was exactly the same time as Mussolini was taking power in Rome with this new movement called fascism.
Fascinating. Why don't we know that?
It's not for lack of trying on my part, let me tell you, because I've written books about it. But it's really, really important. The Klan was, of course, a rebirth of, or, you know, a regrowth of a post-Civil War movement, as you know, right? So there's the first Klan, which is after the Civil War, and then the one in the 20s is the second Klan. What happened was that observers in America were also saying, what is this new thing, the Klan? This is very worrying. What is this thing? And the explanation consistently across the country in newspapers and periodical culture was, if you want to understand what the Klan is, it's what Mussolini is doing in Italy. And if you want to understand what Mussolini is doing in Italy, because they were also asking, what's this new fascism thing this guy Mussolini has cooked up? And they also said, in separate articles, they would say, if you want to understand what this fascism thing is, oh, it's the Klan. They absolutely knew what it was. They recognized the family resemblance was very, very clear. And then what happened was the Klan in the mid to late 20s, there were a series of scandals, sexual scandals and financial scandals. Funny how reactionary right-wing white supremacist groups often implode because of sex and finance scandals, but they did. And so the Klan went into disrepute, but the same individuals were still around and they still had the same beliefs, and they rebranded themselves as fascist groups. Many of the same individuals became self-styled fascists. There was a man called George Dethridge who rebooted, if you like, another of the Reconstruction era white supremacist groups. The Klan is only the most famous, but there were many. And the one that Dethridge rebooted in the 30s was called the Knights of the White Camellia. And he was interviewed by the Saturday Evening Post saying that Hitler stole all of his ideas from the Klan and that the Klan got there first and that basically the Klan should get credit for Hitler. And that was in 1939, right? So interwar fascism in America was real, and it's a direct offshoot. Many of its members were literally the same individuals who were in the second Klan. It is in many ways a direct outgrowth of it. And then there were also versions of European fascism that people attempted to recreate here. But what's really important to understand about fascism, and this is why we don't know that we had American fascism, is because everybody looks at fascism and says, oh, it's something foreign and some toxic disease that Germany caught or Italy caught. We always talk about Hitler as the test case of fascism, as if Mussolini wasn't the one to literally name it. And Mussolini was incredibly admired in America in the 20s and 30s. The Saturday Evening Post loved Mussolini. They thought he was fantastic, and it was the most popular magazine in America. Henry Ford's Dearborn Independent had a subscription of 900,000, and he was circulating the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And Hitler got a hold of a translation from Henry Ford, and there was pure reciprocity between Ford and Hitler. We can go into go on and on about this. But the key thing here is that fascism, because it's ultra-nationalist, is by definition always homegrown. And so we make a mistake if we think it has to look like Hitler or it has to look like Mussolini. No, it has to look like your country, because that's what it is. It's ultra-nationalist. And they warned about this. Americans who were watching this in the 30s saw this very clearly, and they warned about it explicitly. And they said, these are where the famous quotes come from now that circulate all over social media. If fascism comes to America, it will come wrapped in the flag and waving the cross. That is wrongly attributed to Sinclair Lewis, who did not say it, but it was said in the 30s. And people recognized that that was what would happen. They said it would come in a Hearst newspaper, which is like saying it would come in Fox News. That's basically the equivalent, because they recognized that it had to be homegrown. And the people who saw it most clearly were African Americans, because they could see the continuity from the Klan to fascism. And American fascism was anti-Black, the same way that German fascism was anti-Semitic, because there were cultural roots for that anti-Semitism. Mussolini's fascism, for example, was not anti-Semitic. That was not the platform. He got pulled reluctantly into anti-Semitism when Hitler basically forced him into it. But for Mussolini, it was the campaign in Ethiopia. His fascism was much more anti-Black than it was anti-Semitic. And in America, that was the fascism that was taking root. It was also anti-Semitic, of course. It was both. But it was also anti-Black.
Sarah Churchill, you hold Langston Hughes especially high for seeing the Klan fascist connections and saying it very clearly. Explain that.
Yeah, well, he did. I mean, he was one of many, but he's the most famous. But he was one of many African-Americans who called out. They said Jim Crow is fascism. They said, you don't need to tell African-Americans what fascism is. Don't explain Hitler to us. They said over and over again, we know. So the African-American newspapers of the day, and there were dedicated African-American newspapers like Pittsburgh Courier and other ones.
Right. And it was a time, I should say, of the Harlem Renaissance, and all sorts of great writers were emerging, not to mention musicians.
Yeah. I mean, that's mostly the 20s. And now I'm talking about the 30s. But yeah, it's still, you know, a lot of those writers are still writing in the 30s, of course. And so Hughes himself, definitely. Also Zora Neale Hurston, you know, some really famous, wonderful African-American artists working at the time, but also the great historian W.E.B. Du Bois, yes, who published Black Reconstruction in America in 1935. They all recognized it. They could see very clearly that Jim Crow was fascism, and they said so explicitly. And part of the reason why that got ignored was because it was African Americans who were saying it. So we've forgotten that history, not through any lack of effort on the part of African Americans. Black Americans have been telling us this for 100 years and begging white Americans to pay attention.
Sarah Churchill, who must we be reading today to be armed against the fascist chance, the fascist possibility in our country in the 21st century?
It's a good question. If I knew of an antidote, I would be spreading it everywhere. If I thought I could inoculate us from it,
yeah.
I would be spreading that vaccine, let me tell you. I think that the writers who warned us, who watched the first wave of American fascism in the 30s, they have a lot to tell us. A great writer named Dorothy Thompson.
Amen.
Her husband was Sinclair Lewis. They got divorced after a while, but for a while they lived together, and he got the idea for his anti-fascist novel, It Can't Happen Here, which was published in 1935, partly from Dorothy Thompson and her European circle. She'd been a foreign correspondent in Europe during the rise of fascism, and she was America's most prominent anti-fascist campaigner in the 30s. So there are writers, and there's some films for people who like Katharine Hepburn and Spencer Tracy. There's a film called Keeper of the Flame, which is not necessarily a great film, directed by George Cukor, if I recall correctly, but it's very, very interesting to watch right now. And it's very explicit about American fascism, and it has all kinds of chilling resonances with today. The problem with most of these, well, Sinclair Lewis ends, It Can't Happen Here, ends with America on its third dictatorship at war with Mexico. So he doesn't hold out much hope. There is a resistance in Canada, which is nicely prophetic for today. So he doesn't hold out much hope. But most of the other books, not just the ones that were written in the interwar period, but I'm also thinking of like Philip Roth's The Plot Against America.
Yes.
These books all depend on, and the way that Capra does in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, they all depend on the bad guys having a change of heart and, you know, giving up power and saying, whoops, my bad, and recovering their conscience. And I don't think that anybody who's watching American politics today with dismay, horror, shock, despair is under any illusions that any of these people are going to voluntarily relinquish power because they start to feel bad. That is the problem, is that the remedy has always been that like American democracy will out, that our moral nature will reassert itself. And that does not appear to be what is happening. But at least I do believe that not only that forewarned is forearmed, which I absolutely believe, and this has been why I've had this project of working on all of this for the last decade now, since Trump came on the scene in 2015, is that I also believe that if you are horrified by what's happening in your society, that horror is only compounded if you're also bewildered, if you're confused too. Clarity won't make us feel any better in one sense, but confusion makes us feel worse. That's one remedy I can offer, is I can at least offer the remedy of clarity and explanation of how we got here, why we're here. And maybe that can give us some tools for how we can turn it around and rebuild, not what we once had, because, you know, we never had a fully functioning multiracial democracy, but get us back on the path toward achieving one, which I think is the goal, I hope is the goal that still the majority of Americans would like to achieve. So, you know, what Fitzgerald is telling us, everybody talks about the American dream in relationship to the novel, but it's about the American illusion. It's a novel asking the question of what's left of hope when the system is rigged to break it. It's about, you know, what happens when the dream has been packaged and sold to us before we ever even get to it. It's a novel about how power works. It's about how it shields itself. It's about how it breaks the people who still believe in ideals, but it's also about the persistence of those ideals and the persistence of hope, as we were saying before. Fitzgerald has this wonderful line. I quote this in the FT piece that you mentioned. It's very easy to miss. In fact, one of the editors of the piece in the FT thought that I was quoting Fitzgerald wrong because it's such a surprising word that he uses. It's when in the climax of the confrontation at the Plaza Hotel between...
We haven't mentioned the Plaza Hotel, which Donald Trump bought in the late 80s, held through the early 90s. A funny Gatsby token, because it's the climactic moment when Gatsby says, tell Tom Buchanan that you only love me, and Daisy doesn't make the move.
And she doesn't. She retreats back into her marriage. And at that point, Fitzgerald says to us, and I'm pulling up the quote so that I don't murder it because it's beautiful and it's really important. He says, with every word, she was drawing further and further into herself. So he gave that up, and only the dead dream fought on as the afternoon slipped away, trying to touch what was no longer tangible, struggling unhappily, undespairingly toward that lost voice across the room. That to me is what the novel is about. The dead dream fights on even when the dreamer has lost hope, and the dream is unhappy, but it's undespairing, even though the voice is lost. That voice is lost, but the dream is undespairing. We do not give up. As I said earlier, even when maybe we should, we don't. That is the great lesson of the novel for me. It's the moral lesson of the novel. It is the great wisdom that it has about human nature. You know, it is what gives us hope in the sense that, okay, the Buchanans triumph in one sense, but they can't kill hope. They can't.
Can we call it toxic nostalgia or something like that?
Yeah, I go with that. Yeah, I think that's very accurate.
I wanted to quote you from your book, Careless People, in a kind of tribute to this incredibly ambiguous Fitzgerald and his sense of American history, looking backward and forward. You say, Fitzgerald always felt a strong sense of American history at his back. He was buoyed by it as it streamed past him. I look out at it, he wrote in his notebooks near the end of his life, and I think it is the most beautiful history in the world. It is the history of me and my people. And if I came here yesterday, he added, I should still think so. It is the history of all aspiration. not just the American dream, but the human dream. And if I came at the end of it, that too is a place in the line of the pioneers. Aspiration is general, but capacity is limited. Fitzgerald's tale, you write, of a fraudster and the shallow, careless woman he loves would become a story about all of America.
I wrote that 10 years ago. I still think it's true. I guess that's a good sign, right?
Is there anything we can do about it other than look for the novels, maybe write the novel of what we're going through in this chapter?
It's a question people ask me with some frequency, is who do I think is the Fitzgerald of today? And do we think that anybody is capturing this or putting their finger on it? I mean, so first of all, of course, nobody thought that The Great Gatsby was a masterpiece when it came out, except for Fitzgerald. So by definition, we wouldn't know it if it is being published right now. If it's really the Gatsby of today, we would have to be overlooking it.
What if it's a filmmaker we're looking for, or a songwriter for that matter?
Absolutely. It could be. If we get truth, it usually comes where we're not looking for it, right? And so it might come from writers. It might come from journalists. As you say, it might come from other kinds of artists. It might come from whistleblowers. It might come from activists. It doesn't have to come through art either. But it's the same work. The project is to hold up a mirror and to say you cannot look away. That's the project, right? And that's what Gatsby is doing, because it's so beautiful that we are seduced by it, but it's also unforgiving. It's not glamorizing us. If we look clearly at what it's telling us, it is a novel of beautiful surfaces and dark, uncomfortable truths. Those dark, uncomfortable truths are being spoken. Certainly, you know, you and I both, I'm sure, are reading lots of people who are doing that work right now. The question is, are people paying attention? Are enough people paying attention? And is it going to move the needle?
Sarah Churchwell, it is an incredible treat to hear you and to read you, but with your American view of ourselves from a safe distance, but also with a ravenous hunger for the history that we're all going through maybe again. Call when you want to give us instructions, but let us do this again.
I would like that very much. Thank you.
Sarah Churchwell teaches the humanities at the University of London. She has published 4 immersive studies of American life in its popular and literary culture, about The Great Gatsby, as we've just heard, about Gone with the Wind, about the entangled history of America First and the American Dream in the 20th century, and about the many lives of Marilyn Monroe. Here at Open Source, we rely on listener support. If you haven't done your part yet, now's the time. Go to radioopensource.org/donate and pitch in to keep the world's first and longest-running podcast going strong. Open Source is proud to be a member of Hub and Spoke, a Boston-based collective of independent, creator-owned podcasts. Our shows range from history to politics to art to technology. We come together around the principle that independent voices and independently funded media are more important now than ever. You can learn more at hubspokeaudio.org. Thank you.